Welcome to JGL Law For You. JGL Law For You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law For You, we will be discussing a wide array of topics to help you navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. We are back on JGL Law For You, part two of essentially the nuts and bolts of divorce and the practice of divorce, what happens during a divorce in the state of Maryland. Part one, we talked a lot about what the laws are. We talked a lot about fault grounds and so forth, and what you can do to prepare for the divorce itself. So today we've got my good friend and law partner, Chris Castellano, back to kick us off in part two of this, which is now we're ready to file, or now the case is ready to go forward. Chris, welcome aboard.
Yeah, thank you very much, David.
All right, so let's pick up with, okay, you've got your client and now the process starts and you're ready to actually file for divorce. Let's talk about that, what questions you might ask, what issues might come up at that point in time.
Yeah, so one of the first questions I ask my clients, you know, even before they sign a retainer, you need to understand, what county are you in? Where are we? Where are we going to be filing should we need to do that? Because one of the first issues in your case is just that. It's venue. It's jurisdiction. And that's something that we need to figure out first. You know, our office is primarily located in Montgomery County, Maryland. And so one of the questions, you know, most of the clients, frankly, that we get are, you're going to be Montgomery County based and some other of the, local counties. But if you're living in Maryland, Montgomery County, you're able to file for divorce in Montgomery County, for instance. Generally speaking, for jurisdiction in Maryland, you need 6 months of residency in the state and you can file in the state for a divorce. And so that's one of those first primary questions that I'm ticking off the checklist of how we start a case.
What's the difference, Chris, between for those of us out there that aren't lawyers, what's the difference between venue and jurisdiction?
Well, at a base level for our listeners, the jurisdiction for what we're talking about is Maryland having jurisdiction to hear the issues in your case, as well as this, we'll call it geographic jurisdiction. Venue is the specific county. That's the high level version of this in differentiation. And so when I've got a client that says, hey, I live in Montgomery County, right? And my husband, my wife, they live in Montgomery County in a separate house. Okay, well, your venue is going to be Montgomery County. And then it starts to get a little bit more interesting if one person's moved out and maybe they're living in Howard County, maybe they're living in PG County or Frederick. And then you've got a question where you're going at that point. But that's kind of the very basic level understanding and explanation of venue versus jurisdiction.
During the course of the litigation, let's say you file a lawsuit, but you've got a client who, and we all know that the wheels of justice don't turn all that rapidly, generally speaking. You have a client who needs support, needs money for either child support or spousal support. Is there a way to get that for that client while the case is pending?
Well, yeah, that's what we call in Maryland pendenti lite support or relief. That's what I tell clients. It's pending litigation, right? It's you filed your complaint for divorce. You have various different needs as expressed in the divorce complaint. And you don't have the ability to wait until your final trial date or a custody trial date. In Montgomery County, we have a custody trial first and then a final divorce trial. Not necessarily the case with the other surrounding counties. But nevertheless, the calendar inherently is going to make you wait a certain amount of time. You know, I would say on average, it's at least 6 months. Maybe you could correct me if I'm wrong there, but I've seen it basically no less than 6 months to get a custody trial, which means if you're in a situation where you need some type of immediate support, whether that be, like you said, immediate child support, immediate spousal support, maybe even attorney's fees, or the access arrangement is a mess. You need the opportunity to correct that messy access arrangement. And a pendenti lite hearing is a very brief hearing. It's generally speaking, it's before a magistrate, not a judge. And you go before the court and that magistrate to talk about the immediate needs pressing. And you could have a ruling on those immediate needs, oftentimes right then and there.
So if you need to have that hearing, whether it's for support purposes or whether it's for in order to set a schedule when the children are with their parents, Does it matter in the long term in terms of what the court does at that temporary hearing?
Well, it's not supposed to, right? But I think we all can acknowledge that it does. Because if you have an access schedule set by the court on pendenti lite basis, and it's saying every other week, let's just say 50-50, right? And it's a week on, week off access-wise. What's going to happen by the time you get to the custody trial is that the kids haven't been pushed onto the street when they're with mom or dad. They're not getting into trouble. They haven't failed their classes. They're not being neglected over at one parent's or the other's food-wise or medicine-wise or what have you. And so the reality is that the court's going to say, well, all right, I've got a situation here at the custody trial that for the last 8 months, or realistically 5 months, you've had a PL and it's worked. And what the court's really looking at in these cases is what is in the best interest of these children and what works for them. And so a PL schedule is very important because it can set the tone for your case. And it really shifts it away from what do you want for the kids to the court's first opportunity to say, what does the court think is best for the kids?
So is it more likely or less likely that when you get to a final hearing on whether it's access or support issues, that a judge at that point in time is going to give deference to that pendente lite, that temporary order?
I mean, personally, I think they're always going to give deference. I think they're always going to look at it as another individual in this courthouse ruled this way and recommended this based on what they heard. Now, there's a big caveat there, right? A custody trial is generally 2 to 3 to 4 days long, which means each side gets, for a 4-day trial, each side gets 2 days to present evidence, to present testimony, to present argument about why a certain custody situation should or should not happen. A PL in Montgomery County now is 3 hours. That's an hour and a half each, which means that what you're presenting to the court is very limited. Now, I think you're going to struggle, and this is entering into advice, and we should say again, I'm not offering legal advice here, but just general impressions. But once you go through a PL hearing, a pendenti lite hearing, and the court's ruled one way based on the high level, highlight, real facts that affect the children, the court's going to say, show me something that's really having an impact on the kids. Yeah, you may not like it. You may not like your husband. You may not like your wife. You may not like the situation that I'm about to order here. But the PL has been happening and the kids are fine. And so tell me why I should go away from what the court's already ordered. I mean, how many times, David, have you had a judge that used that exact phrase? Tell me why I shouldn't do this.
All right. Even though that judge is not supposed to do that.
No, absolutely. But at the end of the day, they're not supposed to. But the court has now a track record. And frankly, what the court's tasked with is, hey, this couple has separated. That's a terrible situation for these kids. And now there's a new access arrangement. Now I've got evidence of 5 months. And I keep going back to that. We'll just use it. 5 months of access happening based on this schedule. So I have actual evidence of how that's where, you know, telemetry.
Real data. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's so many analogies I can use sports-wise, motorsports-wise, whatever it may be. But the fact remains is that when you have that data to work with, that's as good as gold. And if the court's looking at that data, they're going to say, okay, I'm not paying deference to the PL order necessarily. I'm looking at the last 5 months and the kids are okay.
Okay. So let's shift a little bit from that area of things to what happens in terms of getting documents, exchanging documents, the discovery process that everybody, that a lot of people have questions about. What is it and what are you able to get? What happens if people try to hide things? That's a lot of questions built in there, but this is a top-down episode, so let's do it.
Yeah, so everyone knows and they've heard about discovery. They've watched TV shows. Everyone's watched all the different, you know, if you've watched Suits, you've watched LA Law, you've watched whatever it may be. And everyone's talking about like the 40 boxes in their litigation case against a major corporation. Okay, that's discovery. Now, is your divorce case going to have 40 boxes of documents? No, not a chance. But what you're going to do is still engage in a very thorough very wide sweeping discovery. You know, I tell clients when I'm preparing discovery is that I cast a very, very wide net. I try to get as much information as I can relevant to your case. And then once I get that first batch of information, I start to whittle it down, right? And I start to really focus in on issues that are really going to impact your case. And that's your broad stroke approach to discovery, right? And that, and I think, frankly, that's shared by most attorneys out there. I can't imagine you do anything else. And so what is relevant? Well, the reality is that you're getting divorced. And so your finances are relevant. The access is an issue. So that means that, you know, your communication with your spouse is relevant. Communications with your extended family is relevant when it's specific to items such as your kids, such as your wife or husband or whatever it may be. And so when you start to break it down, and you can look at it the opposite way. Oh, well, how is this relevant? Okay, well, you know, look at it from the perspective of, did you ever talk to your Uncle Frank about your wife? Well, then that means that text message is relevant, right? You may not understand or appreciate why it's relevant, but that's up for, you know, the other side to determine its quote unquote probative value. And so I tell people that in a divorce case, your whole life is relevant. And that's unfortunate, but that's the reality of it.
Do people tell you, look, here's this document, whatever it may be. Maybe it's a bank account that they think their spouse doesn't know about. Here you go, but I don't want her to know. I don't want him to know. I don't want them to know about it. So don't produce it. A, does it happen? And B, what do you do?
It certainly happens. And people certainly have those requests. And that doesn't fly with me. When we get information in that the other side's entitled to, it's going to the other side. Right. I'm a big fan of understanding vulnerabilities in a case and mitigating those risks and vulnerabilities. That's what we do, David. Right. I'm a risk manager. More than anything else, I'm a risk manager. And so you've tasked me with the job of mitigating and managing your risks, which means that let the other side know your vulnerabilities and let's work on how we can mitigate those. That's my approach. But I don't play games of hiding the ball or hiding discovery.
As an aside, what do you do if you find out that the other side is doing that? In other words, we've had this happen before, right? You get documents from the other side and then your client says, well, hold on a second. There was a bank account, Bank of America. Here's a copy of the statement from 2 months ago. You got the statement, but the other side hadn't produced it. What do you do then?
Yeah, then you start. So like I said, your first foray in discovery is sending out those document requests, right? That's your wide net. Your next level starts to be more focused. Okay, well, I didn't get the, I think you said Bank of America. I didn't get the Bank of America money market account, right? And I know it's there. I know it's there. All right. So then we send out a subpoena to Bank of America. Right? We're allowed to engage in third-party subpoenas and discovery. So we get that information from Bank of America. But what I'm also doing, David, is I'm sending a demand to the other side that says, hey, listen, we're well aware of this account, or this issue. Hey, you didn't give me any communications with Uncle Frank, right? You need to give me this stuff. You're required to give me this stuff. Here's the rationale as to why you're required to give this stuff. And then at that point, you know, you've got two irons in the fire, right? You've got your third party subpoena outstanding, and then you've got, you know, your request, your communications with the other side in good faith to try to get information. It's how those two items are responded to, whether that be by the Bank of America or the other side trying to obstruct the Bank of America subpoena, or the communication from opposing counsel directly on that issue. And that's what dictates the next level. And that could be filing a motion with the court to try to deal with that.
I see. So now we're at the question of what happens. Do most cases go to trial? Is there another way that cases can be resolved? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that most of these cases are settling. I think that you would share that view.
I would.
That's certainly my experience. Most of these cases settle, and for good reason, right? The people had their entire life of controlling the outcome of their lives and decisions, especially when it comes to their kids. And so I say this not to pass judgment on people that end up going to trial, but the reality is that people start to understand the bigger picture and the reality of the situation and why it's actually far more beneficial for their kids to simply settle the case, to dictate the terms of how a case is resolved and not sit in front of a judge who comes out with the same speech that, listen, I don't know your kids, I don't know you, and I'm going to learn about you in the next 3 days, and I'm going to make a judgment based on what I've learned in 3 days. But you know your kids over the past, you know, 16, 15, whatever many, you know, however many years, and you know your spouse for even longer. So you're in the best position to be able to resolve this case. And I truly believe that, which is why I certainly encourage people to resolve their cases in a good way, because no matter what, a solution that is born out of a settlement is always going to be preferential over a trial.
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly on the same wavelength there. And I tell my folks, as we approach the possibility of, and we're dealing with custody for just a moment, and access, obviously, or decision-making, and that is, these parents have the opportunity to make a decision for their family that's going to affect their family for the rest of their kids' lives. Or they can leave that decision up to, you know, someone in a black robe who will open a file the morning the case starts and close it the minute he or she makes a decision.
They're moving on to a criminal case or a, you know, some contract dispute case. They don't have the luxury of time to be able to worry about your case and your family to see if what they actually ordered was good or not, right?
Chris, how do cases get settled? I mean, you and I have been round and round about different options, but how, someone out there might say, okay, well, I want to try to get my case settled. What are different ways to do that?
As I tell people, your case runs along two different tracks, like two different train tracks with the same ending. That ending is the solution of your case, right? It's either going to be once the gavel drops by a judge or once you sign on a dotted line for an agreement. But you can pass between those two different tracks at any point until that final solution happens, right? And so does that mean that you're stuck doing litigation or stuck doing settlement? No, of course not, because you could travel freely between the two. And so if you're sitting there saying, like, listen, I've got a PL hearing coming up on February 14th or February 13th, rather. Yeah, I want to solve my case. I want to resolve it. I don't want to go do this trial and rip each other apart on the stand. And once you have that realization, right, because I think that the first step is really having that enlightened approach of, I think it's better that I resolve this case and I compromise. Right? The ever aspired to goal of compromising with people in this situation. Once you get past that point, then it becomes a lot easier to wrap your head around the nuts and bolts, if you will, of how to settle your case. It requires that mentality shift of, I don't want to go to battle. I want to move on.
And a lot of people come to me and assume that everything that we have between me and my spouse is going to be divided equally. Now, is that true in Maryland?
So in Maryland, we don't necessarily split things 50-50. We're an equitable distribution state. And that means that the court's going to analyze the different equities existing between you. That means, you know, different reasons, perhaps, that we should deviate away from what would be considered 50-50. As I tell people all the time, listen, no court's going to tell you that they've got a 50-50 this thing. The reality is, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn. I think that a lot of judges would probably acknowledge this over a drink with you, is that, yeah, they're going to start at 50-50, but they're not bound by any stretch to say at 50-50. They've got to see and hear evidence that allows them to say, you know what? I think that this person used $50,000 in an improper way. And so I'm going to deviate away from that 50-50 to quote unquote balance the equities. So to answer your question, no, we don't 50-50 everything necessarily, but in common practice, it ends up looking very similar to a 50-50.
Yeah, I mean, it's easier if I'm Judge Bullitt, which thankfully I never tried to be Judge Bullitt, but if I am, it's easier and more efficient for me because I got other cases on my docket that are coming up to just draw a line down the middle of the page or divide by two. This person treated the other this way, or maybe I should factor in this, and that should have a dollar value to it, right? I mean,
yeah, I mean, the easiest calculation you could do is X amount of dollars divided by two. And so I think at its core, what does equity mean, right? It's fairness. If all things being equal, the most fair outcome of a case is split down the middle. So it's not wrong to say they're going to start at 50-50 because they're starting at what is considered the most equitable situation.
Now let's shift back to kids for a moment. And I know we're moving through this quickly, folks, because again, this is a top-down sort of view. This is not on the ground. This is from high up. So let's slide over to kids for a moment and talk about the differences between legal and physical custody, what the standards might be in terms of what a court's going to be looking at when it comes to making a custody award.
Yeah. So, and this is often misunderstood, but it's critical, right? Legal custody is decision-making regarding your minor children on major issues. That's not what should Jimmy and Mary wear to school on the first day. But that could be, why is Jimmy and Mary not wearing a coat out on a 23 degree day, right? You know, so it's not a cut and dry issue where you just say, no, this is always going to be a legal custody and this is never going to be a legal custody question. And we could dive into that perhaps a little bit more in depth. But generally speaking, legal custody is your big decisions. We like to think of them as issues dealing with education, health, both medical and mental health, religion, discipline, and general welfare of the child. And so those are legal custody questions. Physical custody is what a lot of people associate the question of custody with, which is access to my child, right? In Maryland, it's really, it boils down to overnights with the child, right? You can think of it as, how many overnights do I have with my child? That's your physical custody.
Okay. So it's more of a schedule.
That's right.
Okay. All right. And is it possible for people to have joint legal custody, but that one parent has more time physically with the children than the other?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I don't think it's too much to go out on a limb to say, I think that that's the majority of the situations, is that the court's going to go ahead and grant joint legal custody, which means that both parents have to sit down and try to make a decision together on the kid. And then your access schedule looks something akin to the every other weekend with mom or dad, and, you know, maybe a midweek dinner on the off week. So it absolutely could look like a joint legal custody where you both are making decisions equally, and then physical custody is not exactly equal.
Okay. Again, folks, sorry for short circuit. Sounds like the last season of Game of Thrones, for those of you who watched that, which was sort of a bit rushed. I don't know if you watched that show or not, Chris, but I digress. Not a Game of Thrones guy?
I'm one of those people who thought that the show ended just fine.
Okay. Well, there you go. Okay. Well, that'll be for another show.
No, that's another show.
Another discussion. Okay. So let's get away from the Targaryens and let's talk for a moment about, you're now divorced. What do you get from the court to tell you that you're divorced? And what is it and what does it do?
Yeah. So in Maryland, our decree of divorce is called a judgment of absolute divorce. And what it does is that it tells you, you are adjudicated divorced from your husband or wife, right? The moving party, which is the party who filed a complaint, and that complaint that was actually heard by the court, and it could be a counterclaim or what some people refer to as a countercomplaint. That's the other side's version of the same thing. But it basically, the court saying, you are divorced as of this day, right? If you divorce by way of an agreement, your divorce decree judgment is going to, quote unquote, incorporate, and it should but not merge that agreement into the order. If you don't have an agreement, you're going to have a much longer order that's going to stipulate various different terms of the judgment, what the court found following your trial. It's going to have custody terms. It's going to have property terms. It's going to have support terms. Whatever the relief that was requested at trial says, and whatever the court was willing to grant, that's what's going to be in your judgment.
And is the divorce final, you know, right away, or is the, once that judgment is issued?
No. The answer is that you have to wait until, this sounds a little silly for our listeners, but you have to wait until the clerk actually stamps it. I should rephrase that, because now they just use a computer program to add a little stamp at the top. So they're not actually physically stamping it like the good old days. But once the court incorporates it into their system, it's considered a final judgment. But even then, David, I would say, and I caution my clients, that your judgment is still technically susceptible to an appeal 30 days following the date on which the clerk entered that judgment. So I always tell people that you have what I consider a provisional final judgment of absolute divorce, which means don't go and get married within the next 30 days. Just save your follow-up marriage until 31 days.
Okay, so now I'm divorced. Let's get to this sort of last piece. Are there common sort of to-do items after the divorce is granted?
There's certainly, and I think that we do a good job of this, of really trying to explain, hey, item X, Y, and Z, those are things that happen post-divorce. That's going to be retirement entitlements, right? You know, there's various different orders that are necessary in order to submit for retirement benefits from your spouse. But then there's also understanding the custody reality of your order, assuming it's a custody order, right? A judgment. And so you need to understand, like, you know, let's say it's setting up supervised visitation, or it's setting up a parent coordinator, right? Or it's setting up various different communication protocols under the order, like using Our Family Wizard, which a lot of our listeners probably are well aware of. And so if you have to do a very good job and a very thorough job of reading that judgment and communicating to your lawyer to understand the exact specifics of what your obligations are, what your entitlements are, and how you're supposed to proceed in the next preceding months.
I mean, I have found that a lot of times folks sign this agreement, they get divorced, and then they sort of forget about what they negotiated for. And which is unfortunate, because you spent a lot of money and time and effort to get that resolution, or there's a judgment that was tried and you forget what you're supposed to do or what you're supposed to get. Have you experienced the same thing with your folks?
So in my cases, what I generally experience is, you know, sometimes you certainly get the buyer's remorse people on an agreement, right? There's no doubt about it. They're going to say, hey, listen, are you sure we bargained for this? Oh, yes, my friend, we did. You know, this is what you asked for, or this is what you were willing to give up. And then there's the people that certainly try to go back on that. But by and large, I find the people, there's a fog of war, if you will, when they're going through the process of negotiating an agreement, and that's certainly present. And that once that dust settles, they can start to think clearly. And so that's usually what causes them to reevaluate, to say, yeah, I'm not sure I'm okay with this situation. That's when you start entering that era of what I call the pre-era of post-judgment litigation and possible modifications. And that might be a good topic for another day. But just briefly put, if you have a judgment or you have an agreement, you know, and you were able to squeak it through because it was just so tough to get this agreement in, but you know that there's some issues you're looking at and say, you know, I don't know if this is going to work. And then sure enough, you know, you start to look at this and things are falling by the wayside. They're not happening the way they should. They're not happening the way that they were intended to do. That's when you start documenting. That's when you start understanding exactly what those, you know, rights and responsibilities under the contract, under the judgment are. And so you build your case for a post-judgment modification.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I do, because I have, you know, I have folks, and there's and you know, sometimes these agreements, Chris, right, are like, you know, it can be 30 pages long, 25, 30 pages long. We try to keep them more slim if you can. But one of the things I like to do with folks is to sort of give them what I call, it's a sort of a cheat sheet to your agreement. It's sort of a, you know, I call it a one sheet, which lays out, points to the particular provisions in the agreement, but lays out what you have to do by a certain time. For example, ex-husband's due to pay you X amount of dollars by this date. If you don't remember, you got to leaf through that lengthy agreement, or you give them sort of this sort of cheat sheet kind of thing, which I've found with most clients, it's very helpful.
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree. I also use the summary of the agreement and let them know, hey, this is what you are entitled, you know, keep an eye out for this, you know, keep an eye out for this. Let me know when this happens. Let me know if you're having difficulty, you know, collecting this monetary award, you know, let me know if there's an issue with the IRA or whatever it may be, right? That's absolutely, we engage in the same level of post-judgment of absolute divorce care with our clients to make sure that they fully understand what they are, quote unquote, entitled to.
Now, we've talked for over two episodes here, close to an hour in total, which we could probably do 30-hour class on all of this. But if you can give folks that are listening two or three takeaways from this sort of nuts and bolts of divorce in Maryland that we've been talking about over the last couple of episodes.
In my experience, what I've really recognized and what I try to implore my clients is you got to enter the right mindset with these cases, right? You know, you're not going to go into these cases and you're not suiting up for battle and getting ready to tear the other side apart. You know, you've got to understand that in 99% of these cases, you're still living with this person. Maybe not in the same house, but you're going to graduations, you're going to weddings, you're going to baptisms and, you know, whatever it may be, first kids for your grandkids and all that. So you're always going to be connected to this idea that you're done is illusory. And so you have to have the right mindset, and slicing and dicing each other is not the right mindset. That is a very expensive, that is the way that David, you and I win, not the way that the client wins, right? So you have to approach it in the right way. I spent a lot of my time talking to clients to listen, it's not in my financial best interest to tell you to look at it this way. But I want to see you succeed in your case and your post-judgment life. And so I want you to approach it in this way because it's better for you. It's better for your kids. It's better for your family. And so approach it in this more, you know, I use the word generous, not to say that you need to give all your money away, but generous insofar as not being so critical of everything, right? And once you have that correct mentality and you're approaching it in the right way, I think a lot of these little parts fall apart. And I always tell clients that the only way you have a real settlement is if both people walk away somewhat pissed off. Because if you walked away feeling like you got one over on the other person, that's not a settlement. That was a win, right? And so settlement means that you're both going to be somewhat pissed off.
That's another one. You should put that on a t-shirt. Settlement means that someone's if we could fit all that on a t-shirt, it would be a good idea. But Chris, this has been great. Folks, there is a ton of information that's been buried in these two episodes that we've really enjoyed having you, Chris, talking about all of this, giving people sort of a big, broad overview. And I like to say what we've done here is, you know, it's been a mile wide, but only about a foot deep. There's a lot more to know, a lot more to learn. And if you're out there and you want to know more about it, give Chris a call, send him an email. And Chris, how do people get a hold of you?
Yeah, absolutely. You could go to our website, jgllaw.com. You can find me on our website, email me. My contact information's on our profile, but you can call me directly, 240-399-7881. I'd be happy to talk to you about all of your issues.
That's great. Thank you, Chris. As always, we appreciate your time. Folks, we appreciate you listening and hope that all of this has been helpful. As always, this is JGL Law for you.